gentlemen, I think we can start now.
Yeah,
right on time. Before we get into our program, I'd like to pause a moment to remember Bob Winicky, who you may not know, but a lot of us do, that he and Bob Berman founded this organization, the Dallas Philosophers Forum, about 45 or so years ago, and he passed away. He was with us, attended our meeting a couple of months ago.
Yeah, a long ago.
And looked pretty healthy to me. But apparently died suddenly of a heart attack, wasn't
right.
it? Yeah. While he was having dinner with his wife, was it?
Something like that. Watching TV, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, so he was a philosopher, professional philosopher, and like I say, he and Bob Berman were the pillars and really, really got this organization going. So in his memory, I'd like to ask that we have a moment of silence, okay? So, even though his physical body has passed on, his memory is with us. And now, a few little housekeeping things. If you haven't paid your admission, see our treasurer here. It's $5. And if you're a full-time student, it's just $2. We do have our expenses. And make sure, if you've eaten, to take care of your bill before you go. And to also take care of your server and tip them. Anything else we need to say, David? All right. So, our speaker tonight is Taylor Norwood from the University of Dallas. He was born in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Oh, an Indian town, right? Native American, sorry. Grew up then in the Texas Panhandle, and then in Austin, and then in North Texas, kind of moved around. Did your family moved around? Kind of?
Yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah. Went to Baylor, good old Baylor Bear, for undergraduate, and then for graduate studies at the University of Dallas, where he got his MA in philosophy. He has taught at University of Dallas, and now presently is an adjunct professor, instructor in philosophy at Mountain View College. He has numerous academic honors and awards and has done a lot of presentations. He's going to speak to us tonight about Michel Foucault, Frenchman, of course, not the Foucault that did the pendulum experiment. That's a different Foucault. This guy lived from 1926 to 1984. And Mr. Norwood is going to talk about his specialty, which is truth-telling, and has to do with Foucault's paresia, is that right? Okay, before considering, okay. So instead of going through all that, I'm gonna let our distinguished speaker tell us about it. So without any further ado, Taylor Norwood.
Thank you. Playing fast and loose with the term distinguished. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. I'm very excited. I love talking about philosophy, and I'm glad to see that so many people love hearing about it. I often like to begin my lectures with a quote or an epigraph to frame the discussion or kind of set the mood. Tonight I've chosen two, mostly because I couldn't decide on one. The first comes from John F. Kennedy, who once wrote that, quote, "Mothers may still want their favorite sons to grow up to be president, but they do not want them to become politicians in the process." The second comes from Jim Boren. He's a former Senate candidate and a professor of political science from Oklahoma and an old mentor of mine, who observed that, quote, "Politicians may have an occasional affair with honesty, but they marry power." It's no great secret that politicians do not always have the best reputation, especially when it comes to honesty. In the hierarchy of stereotypical liars who populate stand-up routines and dad jokes, they outrank even used car salesmen and lawyers. And no offense to any car salesmen or lawyers that might be here tonight. That politicians lie is not a recent revelation, but it does seem to be a more pressing concern of late. Accusations of fake news and alternative facts fly around Washington and Twitter nearly every day, and Donald Trump's election was claimed by many to mark the beginning of the post-truth era. Indeed, post-truth was chosen as the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year for 2016. Now, despite the connection many writers and pundits have drawn between Trump's election and the growing concern about the truthfulness of politicians, this is not an issue that began with Donald Trump. Post-truth was coined in 1992 in criticism of media coverage of Iran-Contra and the Gulf War. The first presidency labeled as post-truth was George W. Bush's due to disputed claims about the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Fake news is even older, with Thomas Jefferson complaining in an 1819 letter that advertisements, quote, "contain the only truths to be relied on in a newspaper," end quote. It's difficult, if not impossible, to find any decade in American history that does not include some political scandal or some crisis tied to a dishonest politician. But dishonest politicians are not just an American problem either, or even just a modern one. The ancient Greeks offer countless examples of dishonest political leaders causing all manner of crises. One such example comes from the famous Athenian orator Demosthenes, who accused his rival Aeschines of being a bribed agent of Philip of Macedon, the same Philip that would go on to conquer Greece, whose son Alexander would conquer most of the known world. Demosthenes argued that the possibility of a leader deliberately giving insincere advice to the assembly in his own self-interest threatened the entire Athenian political order, stating, quote, "A man can do no greater wrong than by telling lies to a popular assembly. For where the political system is based on speeches, how can it be safely administered if the speeches are false?" End quote. I could give many more examples of dishonest politicians throughout Western history, ranging from the ancient Greeks down to the present day. Instead, I'll just say it plainly. Politicians lie, and it seems that they always have. There's an old joke that I'm sure you've probably heard. How can you tell if a politician is lying? Because his lips are moving. With all of this in mind, tonight I want to consider a variation on that question. How can you tell if a politician is telling the truth? For an answer, I turn to Michel Foucault on the ancient practice of parrhesia. Before I get into talking about Foucault specifically, I'm curious to know how many of you have read or studied. Have anybody read much Foucault? Just a little, okay. Anybody read any of his lectures at the Collège de France? No? I knew that was a long shot, but I thought I'd ask anyway. I had originally planned to include some introductory material about Foucault and his thought in general at this point, but I actually decided not to do that. Foucault wrote too much about too much to try to encapsulate it neatly here, and I'd rather spend our time talking about one particular line of his thought than trying to summarize the whole thing. Besides, with Wikipedia and the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy online, you can get a much more thorough understanding of Foucault a lot faster than I can give it to you here. That said, questions about the relationship between the lines of thought that I'm going to discuss tonight and the rest of Foucault's work are very interesting and very worthwhile. There simply isn't enough time to get into it all tonight. So if you find what I say interesting, I strongly encourage you to read a little bit of Foucault and consider how this relates to the rest of his work. I think it's very interesting, at least. I do want to give just a little bit of context for my chosen topic, though, before we get into it. Foucault was a member of the Collège de France, this very prestigious academy, and it required each of its members to present a lecture series that was free of charge and open to the public every year. Foucault did this beginning in 1970, and each lecture series included about 20 hours worth of lectures. And Foucault would go on to develop these lectures into many of his books. So in the lectures, you see kind of the first stages of what will become many of his books. My talk tonight is based on his final two lecture series at the Collège de France, The Government of Self and Others, which was delivered in the spring of 1983, and The Courage of the Truth, subtitled The Government of Self and Others, Part 2, which was delivered in the spring of 1984. Neither of these were developed into a more polished work because Foucault died in June of 1984, less than 3 months after his final Collège de France lecture. The difference between working from lectures rather than a final published book is illustrated nicely by Foucault's statement in the first of his 1983 lectures that he thought, quote, this year's lectures will be a bit disjointed and scattered, end quote. Why am I telling you all of this? Because if my lecture tonight is disjointed and scattered, it's Foucault's fault, not mine. No, I'm kidding. I tell you this because in these lectures, we see Foucault in the process of working his way through some very complex ideas and trying to clarify his own understanding of them. It's Foucault in the process of raising questions and proposing some preliminary answers rather than providing his definitive stance or definitive response to some of these issues. There are a lot of tangents and a lot of ideas introduced only to be set aside without being fully explored, which makes these lectures both a goldmine and a quagmire. I will impose a bit more organization in my presentation, but please be aware that there are a lot of subtleties and a lot of questions that I'm going to pass over in silence just for the sake of establishing that organization. So if you find the topic interesting, again, I highly recommend you pick up the lectures. One series costs about $15. Almost all of them have been translated into English now. And they're really interesting reading. I find them very fruitful. I'm also telling you all of this because parrhasia, the topic of my discussion tonight, is one of the less known of Foucault's topics. I thought about having a whiteboard just so I could write that one word, but it would be the only word I was going to write. So instead, I'll just spell it. For your benefit, if you want to look it up later, it's usually spelled P-A-R-R-E-S-I-A, but because it is a Greek word that's been transliterated, there are a lot of alternate spellings. The other most common one is P-A-R-H-E-S-I-A. So if you look up either of those, you ought to be able to find information. I'll give you the Greek spelling if you want. That's how I feel about Greek, too. Parrhasia is one of the less known of Foucault's topics. Even people who have read and studied a lot of Foucault are often unfamiliar with these later lectures. They only appeared in English within the last 5 or 6 years or so, so they're relatively new as far as Foucault goes. And I didn't want to leave you with the mistaken belief that I'm talking about like one of the central issues in Foucault's philosophy here. This is what he was most interested in at the end of his life, but his body of work says very little about parrhasia, so I just wanted to be clear about that. Despite the disjointed nature of his discussions on parrhasia, and despite their relative obscurity within his larger body of work, I think this is a topic worthy of serious consideration. And I hope by the end of this talk that you will agree with me. Back to my topic now. What is parrhasia, and what does it have to do with lying politicians? Now, parrhasia can be a difficult term to research and define because it has many, many different uses in antiquity. The most literal translation of the term is saying everything, but it's also translated in various contexts as free-spokenness, as free speech, or as frank speech. It sometimes refers to a particular political right to speak, sometimes to a rhetorical technique, and sometimes to a virtue possessed by a mentor willing to say what his disciple needs to hear, however hurtful or uncomfortable that might be. Now, Foucault is concerned with parrhasia as a particular way of telling the truth, which is identified by the courage of the speaker. In Foucault's own words, quote, parrhasia is the free courage by which one binds oneself in the act of telling the truth. Or again, parrhasia is the ethics of truth-telling as an action which is risky and free, end quote. Got it now, piece of cake, right? We can all have a margarita and go home. What does it mean to courageously bind oneself through truth-telling, which is both risky and free? To answer, I'll follow Foucault's example in introducing something like a textbook scene of parrhasia. This scene comes from Plutarch's Life of Dion, but it centers on Plato. Plato has come to Sicily and begins to teach Dion, who is the brother-in-law of the tyrant of Syracuse, Dionysus the Elder. Dion decides that his brother-in-law, the tyrant of Syracuse, would benefit from Plato's wisdom and does everything he can to foster a relationship between the two, between Dionysus and Plato. Plato is welcomed to the royal court and one day is having a conversation with Dion, Dionysus, and several courtiers. As should surprise no one who has read Plato's Republic, Plato quickly turns the conversation to the topic of justice. He argues that the just man is happy and the unjust man is unhappy. His audience eats it up. They love it. They think Plato is just the wisest man they've ever met, except for Dionysus. Dionysus thinks that Plato's remarks about the unjust man are directed at him, and the fact that his followers are so convinced by Plato just makes him more and more angry. Eventually, he can't contain his agitation and demands of Plato, "What have you come to Sicily for?" Plato replies, "I am looking for a good man." The tyrant responds, "By the gods, it is clear you have not yet found one." Now, Dion sees the writing on the wall and gets Plato out of town pretty quickly thereafter, but not before Dionysus commands another passenger on Plato's ship out of town to sell him into slavery. "This will do him no harm," Dionysus says, "and insofar as he is a just man, he will be just as happy even as a slave." Plato is indeed sold into slavery, but his freedom is purchased very quickly by a wealthy sympathizer. All of this gives us what Foucault calls, quote, his matrix scene of Parrhasia, end quote. So what does this scene tell us about the characteristics of Parrhasia, about this notion of courageous truth-telling? First and foremost, as already noted, it's a way of telling the truth. Plato's lecture and his cutting response to Dionysus declare the truth. Dionysus is not a good and just man, and only a good and just man can be happy. Plato believes this is the truth and distinguishes himself as the enunciator of this truth. The mere statement of truth is not enough to qualify as parrhasia, though. What sets this scene apart from other instances of truth-telling is the risk inherent in the act. Plato, in speaking to Dionysus in this way, opens himself up to tremendous risk. This risk is the key feature of parrhasia. Note that I said risk here and not the actual consequences. That Plato was sold into slavery as a result of his truth-telling certainly illustrates the reality of that risk, but Plato would still have engaged in parrhasia even if no consequences had actually befallen him. Foucault explains, quote, "What makes it parrhasia is that the introduction, the eruption of the true discourse determines an open situation, rather opens the situation and makes possible effects which are precisely not known. Parrhasia does not produce a codified effect. It opens up an unspecified risk," end quote. Thus, and quote Foucault again here, quote, "There is parrhasia from the moment Plato actually accepts the risk of being exiled, killed, sold, etc., in telling the truth." So parrhasia is really that by which the subject binds himself to the statement, to the enunciation, and to the consequences of this statement and enunciation. End quote. In exercising parrhasia, the speaker does not merely state the truth, but puts himself or herself forward as the person stating the truth, and in so doing, affirms that he or she really believes the statement to be the truth, regardless of whatever consequences could result from that statement. The result is what Foucault calls, quote, "an intensification of the truth," end quote, whereby the courage of the speaker in telling the truth confirms the truth of the statement. The courage of speaking verifies the truth of what is spoken. Foucault summarizes the features of parrhasia, which are all evident in the exemplary scene, by stating, quote, "Parrhasia is therefore a certain way of speaking. More precisely, it is a way of telling the truth. Third, it is a way of telling the truth that lays one open to a risk by the very fact that one tells the truth. Fourth, parrhasia is a way of opening up this risk, linked to truth-telling, by, as it were, constituting oneself as the partner of oneself when one speaks, by binding oneself to the statement of the truth and to the act of stating the truth. Finally, parrhasia is a way of freely binding oneself to oneself and in the form of a courageous act," end quote. So, parrhasia is a way of speaking, but not just about anything. It's a way of speaking the truth. it's a way of speaking the truth that lays you open to risk, and you open yourself up to this risk by making yourself the enunciator of truth willingly, openly, through your courage to speak. Foucault goes on to distinguish three modulations, we can call them, of parrhasia. The first is what he calls judicial parrhasia. This consists of the weak proclaiming the injustice of the powerful. He also refers to this as the discourse of imprecation. The second modulation is what he calls moral parrhasia, which is the free confession of one's own moral offenses to a mentor or a teacher who is able to judge those offenses. Foucault also calls this the discourse of confession for obvious reasons, confessing your failings. Although Foucault says both of these ways of engaging in parrhasia are important both philosophically and historically, he does not develop either at length. Instead, he turns his attention to the third form, political parrhasia. It's important to note that in each of these three variations, the fundamental notion of parrhasia as courageous truth-telling is the same. What is different is the subject. So for judicial parrhasia, the powerful individual is the subject of the speech. I chastise you because you use power unjustly. In moral parrhasia, the speaker is the subject. I chastise myself because of my moral failings. In political parrhasia, the subject is the entire political order. I thought I took my water out there. Never mind. It's okay. I'll soldier on. Foucault notes early in his discussion of political parrhasia that parrhasia is, quote, profoundly linked to democracy, end quote. Thank you.
To what, democracy?
To democracy. Parrhasia is profoundly linked to democracy. He goes so far as to say that, quote, for there to be democracy, there must be parrhasia. For there to be parrhasia, there must be democracy, end quote. There is, according to Foucault, a fundamental circularity between democracy in general and the practice of parrhasia. The circularity gives rise to what he calls, quote, the problem of truth-telling in democracy, end quote. To sort out the relationship between truth-telling and democracy and to understand why it is problematic, Foucault identifies the key features of political parrhasia, which form what he calls the constitutive rectangle of parrhasia. The first corner of this rectangle is democracy. Here, Foucault uses it to mean the equality of all citizens and the associated freedom of each to speak and thus participate in political decision-making. Simply put, if people are not free to speak, they are definitely not free to speak the truth, that is, exercise parrhasia. Foucault describes this as the formal condition of parrhasia. This is the form politics must take for there to be parrhasia. The second corner of this rectangle of parrhasia is what he calls the game of ascendancy. Although everyone has an equal right to speak, only a select few rise to the first rank and are thereby able to get others to listen to them. Simply put, you can't engage in courageous truth-telling if nobody will listen to the truth you're trying to tell. To claim membership in this front rank, Foucault explains, a citizen must be of extraordinary personal and moral qualities. Only those figures recognized as being the worthiest among the citizens are able to claim the sort of ascendancy necessary to exercise parrhasia. At the same time, parrhasia reinforces their ascendancy as the members of the select group use their courageous truth-telling to lead the city. Foucault calls the ascendancy and superiority of some citizens the de facto condition of parrhasia. Democracy gives us the form. This ascendancy is the de facto condition necessary for parrhasia to exist. The third corner of this rectangle is truth-telling. This is pretty self-explanatory. If someone isn't telling the truth, then they aren't exercising parrhasia, which we've defined as courageously telling the truth. I'll expand a little bit on the nature of this truth a little later in the lecture, so we'll just put a pin in it for now. The fourth corner of this rectangle of parrhasia, the fourth feature parrhasia must have, is courage. As Foucault explains, quote, since this exercise of the right to speak in which one tries to persuade through a discourse of truth takes place precisely in a democracy, first corner, it will therefore take the form of a joust, of rivalry, of confrontation, with the consequence that those who want to deliver a discourse of truth must demonstrate courage, end quote. He calls this the moral condition, courage in the struggle. A person must have the courage to face rivals, to face criticism, and to face the consequences of his proposals failing in order to exercise parrhasia. Keep in mind, we're talking about a political system in which ostracism and the death penalty were both potential consequences of a failed policy. So when he says it took courage, it took real courage. These are the conditions which must be present if political parrhasia is to function well. These conditions also reveal why the relationship between parrhasia and democracy is problematic. There's an inherent tension between the equality of democracy and the ascendancy required for the exercise of parrhasia. Though all citizens have an equal right to speak, only a small group can claim the ascendancy required to exercise parrhasia. Because this group must possess extraordinary personal and moral qualities to achieve this ascendancy and exercise parrhasia, parrhasia thereby becomes the means of identifying the genuine elite among the citizens. Only the best men are in a position to use parrhasia. I, as a footnote, and women, but we're talking about the ancient Greeks, so they meant men. I include women, just to clarify. Only the best people are in a position to use parrhasia, and through its use, they are recognized as the best. Democracy and parrhasia therefore present something of a paradox. Parrhasia is only possible within the formally equal democratic political order. But parrhasia simultaneously creates a class of elite leaders recognized as superior to everybody else through their courageous truth-telling. For political parrhasia to function well, this tension has to be delicately balanced. We see this in Foucault's example of good political parrhasia. Pericles. If you aren't familiar with Pericles, he was the general and statesman who dominated Athenian politics leading up to the Peloponnesian War, and during the first 2.5 years of that war, up to his death from plague in 429 BC. Foucault gives three examples of Pericles exercising good parrhasia, all of which come from Thucydides. Yes, there's the question of whether or not Thucydides invented all of these examples. Foucault says that's not really relevant to him. What he's concerned about is that these examples exist and were taken as authentic to what the ancient Greeks actually might have done. So the first of these examples is Pericles' speech just prior to the Peloponnesian War. Spartan ambassadors have come to Athens and have essentially given an ultimatum. Either renounce some of your imperial conquests or we go to war. Thucydides describes it like this. Quote, the Athenians called the assembly and were able to express their views. Many of those present spoke out and opinions were divided. Some thought that war was inevitable, others that the decree should not be an obstacle to peace. This shows us the first corner of, end quote. This shows us the first corner of parrhasia, which is democracy. Everyone is free to offer their opinion in the assembly. After everyone expresses their opinions and the assembly is divided, Thucydides says, quote, Pericles, the son of Xanthippus, stood up to speak. At that time, he was the most influential man of Athens, the most skillful in speech and in action. This is the advice he gave to the Athenians, end quote. This gives us the second corner, ascendancy. As Foucault explains, quote, in the democratic game, which gives everyone the right to speak, someone comes on the scene to exercise his ascendancy, which is the ascendancy he exercises in speech and in action. It is both the paradox and genius of Pericles to have been, at the same time, the single most influential man, and yet not to have exercised his power through parrhasia in a tyrannical or a monarchical way, but in a truly democratic manner. End quote. Pericles manages to attain ascendancy without overthrowing the democratic order. He advises, but he does not command. Then we get his advice from Thucydides again, quote, my opinion remains, Athenians, that we should not yield to the Peloponnesians. I am well aware, however, that one is less eager when it comes to action than when one is decreeing war, and that human opinions change according to the circumstances. Yet I see that the advice I must give you is always exactly the same. End quote. Pericles gives his opinion and explicitly claims it as his own. This is what I think is truly the best course of action, and I willingly bind myself to this advice, just like I always have. This gives us the third corner, truth. Pericles says, this is the truth as I see it. Pericles continues, quote, I like to think that in the event of failure, those I manage to persuade will stick to our common resolutions, unless they are prepared to renounce any claim to merit in the event of success. For public affairs, as well as individual plans, often disappoint our expectations. Thus, we usually blame fortune when our calculations turn out to be defective." End quote. Pericles acknowledges both the possibility that his suggested course of action fails, and that his fellow citizens could abandon him in such an event, although he hopes that they remain resolute. This demonstrates the fourth corner of Parrhasia, courage. As Foucault explains, quote, "When a man stands up, speaks, tells the truth, says, 'This is my opinion,' and carries the decision of the assembly and the city, then as events unfold, things may not turn out as expected. What then should happen? Should the citizens turn against the person who brought about this failure? I am happy, Pericles says, for you to turn against me in the event of failure, on condition that, if we succeed, you do not claim any merit for the victory." End quote. This example, according to Foucault, quote, "represents the scene of the good and great Parrhasia, in which, in the framework of a democracy which is respected, where everyone can speak, the ascendancy of those who govern is exercised in a discourse of truth, which is their own discourse and with which they identify themselves, even if this entails risks that both the person who persuades and those who are persuaded agree to share together. Such is the good Parrhasia. Such is the good adjustment of democracy and truth-telling." End quote. Pericles gives us another example of good political Parrhasia in his famous funeral oration, also recounted by Thucydides. In praising the city of Athens in this speech, Pericles says that Athens well deserves the title of democracy, because the city is administered in the general interest and not in the interest of a minority. This sheds a bit more light on the truth condition of Parrhasia. In exercising Parrhasia, the speaker offers what he thinks is truly best for the general interest, and not merely his own or that of his party or his faction. Foucault explains that, quote, "Pericles refers, if you like, to the great circuit, the great trajectory of Parrhasia I have been talking about, in which, on the basis of a democratic structure, a legitimate ascendancy exercised through a true discourse, and by someone with the courage to assert this true discourse, actually ensures that the city will take the best decisions for all. This, then, is what one will be able to call democracy. All in all, democracy is this game based on a democratic constitution, in the strict sense of the term, which defines an equal status for everyone. The circuit of Parrhasia, ascendancy, true discourse, courage, and, as a result, formulation and acceptance of the general interest." End quote. Foucault refers to a third and final example of Pericles exhibiting good Parrhasia. This final example comes at a time of crisis. Athens is being ravaged by plague and has suffered several military failures. This is, of course, the risk that Pericles accepted in recommending that Athens go to war. His fellow citizens blame him. They try to make peace behind his back, and they begin to talk of charging him with being responsible for the failures, which is the first step on the road towards ostracism and maybe the death penalty. He calls an assembly and reproaches them for making him a scapegoat. He reminds them that they accepted his recommendation because of his ascendancy, which Foucault summarizes as consisting of, quote, "seeing the truth, being capable of telling it, being devoted to the general interest, and being morally reliable, honest, and incorruptible," end quote. If, Pericles says, quote, "you admitted that I possess these different qualities, be it only slightly more than others, and if as a result of this you followed my advice for the war, then you would be wrong to accuse me of a crime now," end quote. Foucault explains that this is interesting because we can see precisely how, when people turn against him, the truth-telling politician, the one who engages in Parrhasia that we saw in the first discourse, instead of flattering the citizens and instead of blaming somebody else, shifting responsibility for what has happened, he turns around against his citizens and reproaches them. So, just to be clear, they are really, really upset with Pericles. And instead of trying to calm them down, Pericles turns around and says, "Here's what you're doing wrong, even in this situation." So the next time somebody's angry at you, try pointing out why they're wrong about being angry with you and see how that works out. "You reproach me, but I reproach you," Pericles says. "You reproach me for the decisions which were taken and the misfortunes of war. Well, I now turn to you, and without flattery, I address my reproaches to you." Pericles demonstrates his courage by rebuking his fellow citizens for their lack of resolution in the face of misfortune. even as he risks angering them further. He played his role as truth teller because no other citizen was more capable of identifying and explaining what was in the general interest than he was. No other citizen could claim the ascendancy necessary to exercise parrhasia. If he has failed in identifying the general interest, the blame lies equally with the rest of the citizens, who were not able to produce someone more capable than Pericles. He accepts his responsibility and the risk that comes with it, but he insists that his fellow citizens recognize their responsibility as well. This commitment to speaking the truth, even in the face of crisis, Foucault says, quote, is typical of the person who truly has the sense of parrhasia in democracy, end quote. So to review briefly, political parrhasia is linked to democracy, and the ideal relationship between parrhasia and democracy allows for the worthiest citizens to rise to power and influence through their courageous truth-telling without overthrowing the democratic system and the equality it requires. Parrhasia, then, Foucault argues, is ultimately tied to ethos, to character. A political order which features good parrhasia is a political order that will be fundamentally ethical, because the exercise of parrhasia leads to a privileged position for the most ethical citizens, the citizens with the best character. Parrhasia appears at the foundation of a political ethics as a way of distinguishing between the good and the bad amongst potential political leaders. The ancient Athenians, having established such a system, enjoyed centuries of unparalleled political harmony and peace, which we can still see in action to this day, right? If you know anything about Greek history, you know that this wasn't how it played out. Heracles shows us the ideal of parrhasia in the 5th century BC. In short order, certainly by the middle of the 4th century BC, the system breaks down, and Athens is a hotbed for political tumult and disorder. The cause? Bad parrhasia. As if we hadn't talked enough about parrhasia. Foucault calls the bad parrhasia, quote, the parrhasia which does not work in a democracy and does not remain true to its own principles, end quote. Pericles represented a good balance between parrhasia and democracy, but Foucault says, quote, after the death of Pericles, Athens will represent itself as a city in which the game of democracy and the game of parrhasia, of democracy and of truth-telling, do not manage to combine and suitably adjust to each other in a way that will enable this democracy to survive, end quote. Foucault turns to Isocrates here to demonstrate what this bad parrhasia looks like in practice. Isocrates writes a discourse called On the Peace in 355 BC, as Athens is hearing a proposed peace treaty in yet another war, this one the social war. Isocrates, who supports the peace, says to the assembly, quote, I see that you do not give an equal hearing to the speakers, that you pay attention to some while you cannot stand even the voice of others. Moreover, it is not at all surprising that you act in this way, for your custom is always to throw out speakers who do not agree with your desires. End quote. The formal condition of democracy, of an equal right to speak, has disappeared. Those speakers who disagree with the assembly or displease the assembly are barred from speaking. Isocrates elaborates that, for his part, he's aware that it's tough to oppose the majority, and that in the heart of this democracy, there's no free speech except for the writers of comedy in the theater. In other words, the only people that the assembly will allow to criticize them are the writers of comedies, the theater directors. Foucault explains, quote, in other words, the question raised here is, if you like, the place of criticism. Isocrates reproaches the Athenians for accepting a representation of their own faults, defects, and errors, provided that this is in the theater in the form of comedy. The Athenians accept this criticism, whereas in fact it holds them up to ridicule in the eyes of all Greeks. On the other hand, within the framework of politics, the Athenians cannot stand any criticism in the form of a reproach addressed directly to the assembly by an orator. They get rid of orators or politicians who play this game, end quote. Criticism, which is one of the hallmarks of successful parrhasia, is no longer tolerated by the assembly. An individual is free to speak so long as what he says is pleasing to the assembly. The first condition of parrhasia has disappeared. Foucault notes that this is not the only reason for the deterioration of parrhasia. In addition, he says, quote, truth-telling gives way to something which imitates it, to false truth-telling. And those who deliver this discourse of false truth-telling are precisely the flatterers. What is the discourse of flattery? Demagogic discourse, end quote. He turns to Isocrates again here, who calls out the assembly for getting professional orators to exercise and devote themselves to the skill of rhetoric, not to what will be useful to the state. Just how to give good speeches, how to give pleasant speeches, speeches that people will enjoy listening to. Foucault says that the speaker in such a case, quote, does not say what he does because it represents his opinion, or because he thinks that his opinion is true, or because he is intelligent enough for his opinion to correspond in fact to the truth and what is best for the city. He speaks only because, and to the extent that what he says represents the prevailing opinion, which is that of the majority, end quote. So the truth condition of parrhesia has also disappeared, as speakers are more concerned with flattery and displays of rhetorical skill than with binding themselves to their true opinion of what is in the general interest of the city. This in turn destroys the notion of ascendancy that's necessary for good parrhesia. What qualifies someone to speak and gives him ascendancy is no longer qualities like those of Pericles, this personal moral excellence. From this point on, anybody can speak. It's a constitutional right. But what's different is that everybody actually does speak. In good parrhesia, only the people who recognize themselves as worthy of speaking the truth dare to present themselves as doing so. In bad parrhesia, Foucault says, everybody thinks they're worthy of speaking the truth, which means none of them really are. Everybody has the right to speak in a democracy, but only those who truly belong in the first rank lead and claim their right to exercise good parrhesia. Instead of the best rising to lead, in this bad parrhesia, the worst rise to flatter. Again, quoting Foucault here, quote, in this way, ascendancy is perverted. In other words, instead of ascendancy being exercised through the specific difference of true discourse, the bad ascendancy of anybody is achieved through conformity to what anybody may say and think, end quote. In other words, the way to ascend in bad parrhesia is to give pleasing speeches that the majority will go along with, that the majority will like. The way to exercise ascendancy in this form of democracy is not to courageously speak the truth and rebuke your fellow citizens. The final condition of good parrhesia, courage, also evaporates. Foucault explains that, quote, the armature of this false true discourse is not the singular courage of the person who, like Pericles, is able to turn against the people and reproach them in turn. Instead of this courage, we find individuals who seek only one thing, to ensure their own safety and their own success by pleasing their listeners, by flattering their feelings and opinions. The bad parrhesia which drives out the good is then, if you like, everybody, anybody saying anything, provided it is well received by anybody, that is to say, everybody. Such is the mechanism of bad parrhesia, which is basically the elimination of the distinctive difference of truth-telling in the game of democracy, end quote. So with the disappearance of this distinctive difference of truth-telling, which is Foucault's way of saying with the disappearance of truth-telling as the means by which people distinguish themselves as being elite, parrhesia in the assembly ceases to be courageous truth-telling and becomes the more literal definition that I referred to earlier. Literally, saying everything. Specifically, everything that pleases and flatters the majority. Democracy provides the equality necessary for good parrhesia to emerge. But this same equality is ultimately unable to protect the distinction between the good and the bad among the citizens. Truth-telling turns from a courageous act of the morally worthy to a rhetorical device of skilled orators. The bad but talented citizen claims leadership of the city. This is why, according to Foucault, Plato sees tyranny as the inevitable conclusion of democracy. Democracy is unable to sustain good parrhesia, which is necessary in turn to sustain democracy. The emergence of the tyrant is inevitable. This is Plato's argument towards the end of Book 8 of the Republic, where democracy inevitably deteriorates into tyranny. Foucault will go on to claim that Plato relocates political parrhesia to the education of the tyrant's soul by a philosopher. Plato says it can't be found in democracy anymore. Philosophy then becomes the home of courageous truth-telling because democracy cannot sustain it. He will come... Foucault here will come to see the cynics as the ultimate expression of philosophy as courageous truth-telling because their very way of life is a constant rebuke to any and all citizens of humanity, no longer just limited to the members of a particular political order. Foucault will go on to introduce three other what he calls modalities of veridiction, prophecy, teaching, and wisdom to go along with parrhasia. And he suggests that the possibility of viewing politics and history as the story of regimes of truth-telling that emerge, which are characterized by the changing relationships between the different ways in which we tell the truth. All of these lines of thought are very interesting. A few of them I'm pursuing as part of my dissertation, so I hope they're interesting. But I'm not going to delve any further into them now. I just wanted to indicate some of the general directions Foucault takes this. I've given you enough to process for a little bit. Instead, I'll go to Foucault's summary of what he has said about political parrhasia within a democracy. Quote, "I think that the new problem of the bad parrhasia at the turn of the 5th and 4th centuries in Athens, and more generally the problem of parrhasia, good or bad, is basically the problem of the indispensable but always fragile difference introduced by the exercise of true discourse in the structure of democracy. On the one hand, in fact, there can only be true discourse, the free play of true discourse, and access to true discourse for everybody where there is democracy. However, and this is where the relationship between true discourse and democracy becomes difficult and problematic, it has to be understood that true discourse is not and cannot be distributed equally in a democracy. Not everybody can tell the truth just because everybody can speak. True discourse introduces a difference, or rather is linked, both in its conditions and in its effects, to a difference. Only a few can tell the truth. And once only a few can tell the truth, once this truth-telling has emerged into the field of democracy, a difference is produced, which is that of the ascendancy exercised of some over others. True discourse, and the emergence of true discourse, underpins the process of governmentality. If democracy can be governed, it is because there is a true discourse." And then you see a new paradox now appears. I'm still quoting Foucault here. The first paradox was, there can only be true discourse through democracy, but true discourse introduces something completely different and irreducible to the egalitarian structure of democracy. But to the extent that it really is true discourse, that it is good parrhasia, this true discourse is what will enable democracy to exist and to continue to exist. True discourse must have its place for democracy actually to be able to take its course and be maintained through misadventures, events, jousts, and wars. So democracy can continue to exist only through true discourse. But on the other hand, inasmuch as true discourse in democracy only comes to light in the joust, in conflict, confrontation, and rivalry, it is always threatened by democracy. And this is the second paradox. There is no democracy without true discourse, for without true discourse it would perish. But the death of true discourse, the possibility of its death, or of its reduction to silence, is inscribed in democracy. No true discourse without democracy, but true discourse introduces differences into democracy. No democracy without true discourse, but democracy threatens the very existence of true discourse. These are, I think, the two great paradoxes at the center of the relations between democracy and true discourse. Well, in a time like ours, when we are so fond of posing the problems of democracy in terms of the distribution of power, of the autonomy of each in the exercise of power, in terms of transparency, and opacity, and of the relation between civil society and the state, I think it may be a good idea to recall this old question, which was contemporary with the functioning of Athenian democracy and its crises, namely the question of true discourse and the necessary, indispensable, and fragile caesura that true discourse cannot fail to introduce into a democracy which both makes this discourse possible and constantly threatens it. End quote. I couldn't resist reading this passage at length because I just think it's really, really good. You see how good Foucault is as a speaker and a writer here. I told you, these lectures are a gold mine. There are all sorts of moments in these lectures that, man, that was just really good. Foucault doesn't stop there in his discussion of parrhasia in general, but this is the end of his discussion of political parrhasia in a specifically democratic political work. This quote also brings us back to the present day and to the problem of dishonest politicians. How can you tell when a politician is telling the truth? Athens of the 5th century BC gave us one answer. With the exercise of good parrhasia, you know a politician is telling the truth because the only figures in a position to lead and speak the truth are those who possess such personal excellence that their truthfulness cannot be doubted. Ultimately, this system didn't work. So what can we hope to learn which might be useful to our modern democracy? I have a few ideas. It is not my habit to give absolute answers to these sorts of questions, either when I'm teaching or when I'm presenting like this. Instead, I'll just tell you some of the things I take away from it. You may take something completely different away from it. First, this discussion of parrhesia reminds me of the necessity of true discourse in a democracy. The discourse of good political parrhesia seeks what is truly in the general interest of the entire political order. There is built into democracy this need for truth. Regardless of observations on whether truth is completely subjective, can we know objective truth? That's all secondary. What we know is that there is an expectation that when we engage in a democracy, we are engaging in an act of truth-telling. What the conditions of what qualifies as truth, that's another line of questioning. But we all agree that somewhere in the foundation of democracy, there is some expectation that people tell the truth to one another, that you can rely on your fellow citizens to stick to the political order that you've all agreed to follow. So, the discourse of good political parrhesia seeks what's in the general interest, not just what's in the interest of particular politicians or parties or interest groups or so on and so forth. Second, good political parrhesia allows for the ascendancy of individuals who possess real excellence, but this is not merely technical or rhetorical excellence. Right? We sometimes set aside this question of real, genuine moral excellence when we talk about politicians. And I don't just mean, like, did he have this affair in 1987, but he denied it, but later there's evidence that says that. That's not exactly what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about tabloid notions of morality. I'm talking about this sense that a person tries to make themselves the most excellent person they possibly can be. Excellence in the Greek sense of virtue, right? They don't just try to excel in the political arena. They don't just try to excel in a business arena. They try to excel as a human being in living. That's what democracy needs to sustain itself. This notion of leaders who are the most excellent people we can produce. This excellence is moral excellence. It's excellence of judgment. It's excellence of insight. The great challenge of democracy is that the first sort of excellence can be mistaken for the latter. That's what happens to Athens. I think that the American founders knew that. That's part of the reason they built checks and balances into the system. That's why they limited the power that any one individual can exercise within the political order. But they also recognized there's a need for ascendancy. They codified it. We call it the Constitution. There is a need for ascendancy. We have reduced this to merely electoral ascendancy rather than moral ascendancy. The result is that we wind up with a lot of politicians who are really good at winning elections, but are not necessarily ones who have any great insight into what our general interest truly is. There need not be a difference between electoral and moral ascendancy, however. Our elected representatives are exactly that. They're our representatives. We sometimes lose sight of this and look for candidates who just agree with everything that we think. That's not what a representative is. This is a person who represents you not just in your political thoughts, not just in the policies that you support, but they represent you in your entirety as a person, as a political actor, as a thinking person, as a moral person, as an ethical actor. The politician, the leader, represents you. So rather than seek people who agree with our every position or subscribe to all aspects of a certain party platform, we should seek people we are comfortable in designating as the representatives of our ethos, as the bearers of our character. The third thing that parrhesia reminds me of, and this is a big one for me, is that just as some deserve ascendancy, and thereby some distinguish themselves as superior, that means some citizens are necessarily inferior. In other words, we need the humility to recognize that sometimes someone else knows better than we do. Humility is a big project for me. Montaigne, the French philosopher, famously said that wisdom must be the most fairly distributed quality in all of history because everybody thinks that they got the biggest share. That's what I'm talking about here. We need to allow for the possibility that maybe we didn't get the biggest share of wisdom. Politicians are flatterers. They tell us that we're right about everything. They tell us that we are wise, and that they agree with us because we're so wise. Spend a little time on Facebook, and you'll see that most people have bought into this, that they are the wisest out there, right? We have mistaken our right to speak for the assumption that our speaking is always right. Those are the three big things I take away from Foucault's discussion of good and bad parrhesia. Now, in light of these observations, I think we see a clear burden for the modern-day citizen. The burden of the modern-day citizen is to recognize the need for truth in politics, truth in a fundamental, constitutive sense, to recognize that we are not always the best at identifying the truth, and to recognize the need for leaders who are, or who at least try to be, instead of just trying to get elected or lead their party to victory in the next midterm. The special task of philosophers, and I include everyone here tonight in that category, is to help people recognize these needs, to recognize that we could learn more, that we could continue to seek truth. We don't already have it. If asked what the goal of politics and political philosophy is, we should respond like Plato to Dionysus. We are looking for a good man or a good woman, and not merely a good politician. So how do we tell if a politician is telling the truth? Ultimately, we can't for sure. So you better be really careful in who you choose. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sure there's a lot of questions. Okay, and don't get on the soapbox and lecture, make a question, okay? Yes, back here.
Okay, so, one, thank you for that, it was really informative. But my question about Parisia is, it sounds more like a self-replicating model versus a truth-telling model. So it sounds like in establishing worthiness as first identity, it's about embodying the characteristics of being in democracy versus, and this is all within a political spectrum, it sounds like it's more founded on just replicating what being in democracy is, and especially in this time, I'm sure, with the broad spectrum of like people they were ruling over, establishing who the power is and what the power looks like is really key, but it seems counterintuitive, I guess. So my question in this is truth narrow within the political spectrum?
That's a really good question, and it's important to keep in mind that the ancient Greeks had a completely different notion of virtue or morality or just personal excellence than we do, and the relationship between the individual person and the political order. So it's not that the kind of ascendancy that you exercise in speaking the truth and exercising parrhesia, it's not that that just reflects Athenian democracy, it's the other way around. It's that ideally the political order represents the nature of the people that make up that order. And so the Greeks were always trying to make sure that they produced the best citizens possible, because the best citizens produce the best city. And the best city in turn produces the best citizens. So it is kind of the self-reflective circle. So the question of is truth narrow? Their truth has to conform to their notion of excellence. And in order to be worthy of speaking the truth, you have to demonstrate that you are excellent. Not just because you exhibit the characteristics of democracy, because democracy was not a stable institution for the ancient Greeks. Athens claimed to have democracy, but if you read Greek history, democracy goes out the window every 5 or 10 years in Athens. There's another civil war, another tyrant rises to power, another political dynasty comes to power. So democracy was a more fleeting concept than excellence was to the Greeks. So it's excellence that you needed in order to exhibit parrhesia. Democracy needs that same excellence in order to sustain itself. When that excellence goes out the window, so does parrhesia and so does democracy. So Pericles is a great example because he was so excellent. He was so excellent that he could resist the temptation to recognize, like, hey, how great am I compared to everybody else? I ought to just be the tyrant. He doesn't do that. He maintains democracy, which is very, very rare for the ancient Greeks. So his excellence sustains democracy, but it's not limited to a particular notion of democracy. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Sure.
I'm wondering, since Herbert Marcuse is a contemporary of Foucault's, and since he wrote his critique of pure tolerance in 1965, whether in any of the readings of Foucault's lectures in 80 or whenever or perhaps admirers of Foucault or later who analyze that and learn more relating it to other writers on the subject, whether you read anything about the relationship between Foucault and Marcuse in terms of what maybe Foucault said about him or what followers of Foucault said about his ideas, is whether you agree with him politically or not. I think there's something to what Marcuse was saying about, you know, open voices and how you accomplish that's another matter.
Right. There's, as far as I know, there's nothing explicit in at least these later two lectures. I have not read all of the lectures as closely as I have read these later two. I'm confident in saying that there are no references to Marcuse in these later two lectures. As for somebody else making the comparison, I have not seen that done, but I would be willing to bet that somebody has done. There's just so much secondary literature on both of them that I'm sure somewhere out there somebody has at least begun to draw a line between the two, but I don't know who it is. I don't know where to point you.
And if they have it,
that's right. Yeah, that'll be the next book.
Walk over here.
Sure.
I really enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
I'm trying to keep this brief. I'm really a fan of the psychology professor Jordan Peterson, and he has this hypothesis that where he says that in every interaction, if you speak the truth, no matter what happens, good or bad, it is the best possible thing that could have happened. I kind of thought about that a lot during your talk, and I was curious what your opinion of that hypothesis was.
I think that's a good hypothesis. I wouldn't necessarily credit Peterson with coming up with that. I have not read extensively of Peterson. What I have read, he's really good at assembling very profound notions from a diverse range, and I think that's one of them. I think that's a fundamental observation at the core of a lot of different ethical systems, that whatever your situation is, the best possible course of action is to at least be truthful. Truthful in the sense of be authentic. Express what you authentically think to be the case. I think that's kind of what Foucault is getting at here. So yeah, I would agree with that.
Could you comment on the nature of your dissertation?
People ask me this question all the time. In broad strokes, my dissertation is about the practice of what philosophers call veridiction, because philosophers can't say anything simply. It's the practice of truth-telling. I'm in the early stages of my dissertation. There are three different ways I am interested in approaching this practice of truth-telling, the practice of veridiction. Foucault on parasia is one. Another is through Plato's understanding of truth. So if you've read The Republic, you're familiar with the notion of the noble lie. And Plato introduces this interesting idea that you can have lies that are also true in a deeper sense than the superficial. And then you can have things that are objectively true, but they're not worth repeating in the city. They're damaging to the city, so we should reject them as though they are lies. Which, when you think about it, is kind of a problematic notion. So that's the other way into veridiction. And then a third is also related to Foucault. He will go on to say that philosophy takes over parasia, first in the moral instruction of who will be the tyrant. Plato, that's his political take on parasia. But then he thinks eventually Christianity takes over parasia and they turn it into institutionalized confession. And he says, with that, parasia dies. Once you force people to speak the truth, then it's no longer a courageous expression of their freedom to speak the truth. I think that that is true in a narrow sense, but I think Foucault is really short-sighted in his understanding of wider confessional practices than just institutionalized confession within the Catholic or the Christian Church. So I try to recover a different notion of moral confession. He says that essentially the church is so dominant that when they say everybody has to confess, it gets baked into all aspects of society. So even if you aren't religious, you feel this need to confess the truth of yourself, and that's programmed into you by the centuries of church dominance. I think there's another tradition of confession besides the specifically Christian or institutionalized practice that I think Foucault is kind of... He is accused sometimes of turning a blind eye to trends that he doesn't necessarily like or that he doesn't want to deal with. I'll be more generous than that. I think he just didn't recognize the existence of this other trend. So that's another approach that I take in. Which of the three will be my actual dissertation? I'm not sure yet. I'm writing all three as though they're each going to be it, and I'm hoping somewhere along the line I'll realize one of them is going to be easier to finish first, and the other three, the books I write when I'm a professor, hopefully. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we think of democracy as egalitarianism, but it sounds like in Foucault's interpretation and Plato's interpretation, it's an elitist thing. And the Founding Fathers of America kind of illustrates that, because they were the elite, and they set up a system where the Senate was directly elected by legislators who were the elite in their state. So it wasn't very, I mean, and only, you know, landed white men could vote. So how do you feel about that? I mean, Plato ultimately came to the conclusion of the philosopher king as being the way to go. So is democracy, should it just be led by the elite?
That's a good question. The challenge of democracy is that there is always an elite. Now, you can codify it and say we're going to treat the elite as landed white men, and that's going to be our official elite and make our political decisions. Or you can say everybody is going to be the elite. But within that everybody, somebody is going to emerge as the leaders, because not everybody can lead. Somebody has to follow. That's just the way leading and following works. That's what Foucault is getting at here. In good parasia, in a good democracy that will sustain itself, the elite are the ones who are morally worthy, who have this just excellence of person to deserve to lead. That's what makes them the elite. In bad parasia, you don't distinguish between the good and the bad in an ethical sense. Instead, you get the talented versus the not-so-talented, or you get the pleasing versus the displeasing. So you have a different elite emerge that are only interested in maintaining their own status as elite. And then democracy just kind of falls apart. That's what Foucault says here. Plato, that's essentially his explanation of democracy and the republic, that democracy, you have as many politeias, as many constitutions as you have people. Because in a democracy, everybody's free to be their own form of government, which means you have no cohesive political order, which means you don't have any sort of stability or anything. He does say that democracy at least allows for the possibilities of philosophers to do what they do. But the goal for Plato is aristocracy. So he presents the philosopher king, that's the ideal, the wisest possible person, but he also plants little seeds along the republic to tell you that he's not really serious about the possibility of the philosopher king. But what he's really after is aristocracy, which is, by definition, the rule of the best. Now, in an ideal world, democracy would produce aristocracy. That's the democracy of good parasia, according to Foucault. The problem is it's really hard to sustain that, because you only have to pick one wrong person to be ascendant, and then democracy's out the window, you've got a tyranny. Or the majority realizes, you know what, we don't like this guy up here who thinks he's all high and mighty telling us how we're wrong about everything, and that he knows better than we do, so there are more of us than there are of him, let's vote for someone else. So either way, democracy, understood as Foucault sees it here, good democracy that produces aristocracy falls apart. Does that answer your question?
Well, it's complicated.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Pericles was kind of idealized by Thucydides. We don't know
who right.
said all that. I mean, he was that noble. After all, he was kind of a benign demagogue himself.
Right.
A benign tyrant.
Wonderful.
Okay. The thing is about present politics, okay, in our democracy, the United States democracy, and I'm old enough to remember, you know, from Truman on, a few presidents have been courageous enough to have parasia and were failures. Jimmy Carter, George Bush Sr. I mean, these were moral people. Harry Truman, they said what they believed. They were moral. They didn't have affairs. But they were not elected, or were not reelected. So that brings up the question. And this was an Irish politician in, you know, Boston, let's say, was telling a friend of his, look, it doesn't matter what you believe or what your morals are, the important thing is to get elected. And after you're elected, then you can be moral. So is parasia kind of a thing to look forward to, but is it kind of almost impossible in our present kind of democracy?
That's a really good question, and it's something that Foucault does not bring up. I told you he has all these tangents in there that I've kind of glossed over. He does not bring up if the person who exercises parasia has to be always truthful about everything. So the example I think of, to give an even older one than Truman, is Abraham Lincoln, right? When Abraham Lincoln is campaigning for president, he promises up and down that he's not going to get rid of slavery. That's not what he's after. He just wants to stop the expansion of slavery. He says what he needs to say in order to get elected. Now, he argues that slavery is bad, no doubt. But he says what he needs to do to get elected. And then when he's elected, he does differently.
That's right.
So does that mean that Abraham Lincoln doesn't have the moral ascendancy necessary to be recognized as somebody who exercises parrhesia? I don't think so. I think, and this is where my two of my three notions that I'm going to explore, hopefully in books, intersect. I think this is what Plato's after when you have this notion of lies that contain a deeper truth, or I might expand it to say it, lies that serve a deeper purpose. So yes, superficially, this may be a lie, but it is in the interest of the expression of a greater truth. So your question of can people who tell the truth or are moral get elected, they can if they lie, for sure. Is that what we want, and does that make it more difficult to identify parrhesia? Probably so.
Yeah.
That's one of the great challenges here.
That is.
So my question is about the part of parrhesia, I guess, that the truth requires, has to require courage.
Right.
So I know that you said that it's, you know, connected to moral fiber and whatnot, but if the frame of reference of what is virtuous or something is shifted to a point where in that society what we would consider virtuous is not virtuous, and so, or if is really virtuous, and then so the person, so speaking things that we consider virtuous in that situation that doesn't require courage.
Right.
And speaking something that might be terrible to what we consider virtuous, it does require courage. And then what can that produce, and is that still parrhesia?
No, I think that's exactly what Foucault's after in this deterioration of parrhesia. So the moral character of the leader, that's their claim to ascendancy. Courage is kind of the proof of what they're saying as the truth. So if they're courageous enough to willingly and openly accept the risk of what they're saying, then that kind of verifies that they think that it's true. So why would you risk ostracism and death in the interest of something that you don't really believe in? And the answer in good parrhesia is you wouldn't. So as for shifting notions of morality, that's essentially what you get in bad parrhesia. The assembly is no longer concerned with what is excellent or what is courageous. In fact, they detest it. So you have the courage to stand up and rebuke us, well, we're going to kick you out of the city, or we're going to put you to death. That is the shift from good to bad parrhesia, is that courage is no longer recognized as this criterion for telling the truth. The assembly is no longer interested in hearing courageous truth. They have redefined what is good speech as what is pleasing to them, or what is rhetorically good.
Well, I guess I mean, like, if we were a society, just to use something as an example, if we were a society where we all said eugenics is not real and that's not, you know, a real thing, and somebody were to bravely speak towards, I don't know, is that still?
Yeah, that lines up with something that I pondered a lot but haven't necessarily reached any conclusions, is the notion of whistleblowers in modern society. So like you have an entire corporate culture that is doing something bad, and you have one person within that culture who's willing to stand up and say they are doing this bad thing. I think Foucault would say, yeah, that's an example of parrhesia. That's an example of courageous truth-telling. Now, what happens to that person is the risk that is inherent in parrhesia. So nobody listens to them, they get fired from their job, or worse, that's the risk you take in order to present yourself as the truth teller. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We have to get out of here by 9 o'clock, so this is the last question, okay?
Okay, I'll try to put my thoughts together and keep it brief.
You've got me convinced that parrhesia is a good thing to happen in a democracy. The thing is, there's two poles here. There's truth-telling and there's truth-listening. And truth-listening requires its own kind of moral quality.
Right.
Truth-telling requires character and courage. But to be a truth-listener, you have to be willing to tolerate discomfort. You may hear things that you don't want to hear. You have to have a capacity for humility or even shame. And this is one of the things that bothers me, and where I think the parrhesia is breaking down in our culture right now, is nobody wants to be on the receiving end. I mean, we like to identify with the heroic side of
Parrhasia, which is the lone individual telling the truth and, you know, at great personal risk. But for this act, this speech act to occur, there has to be the receptive act. And that's the part we don't want to focus on. But it seems to me there's equal moral virtue there in being able to recognize when you don't have the answers and someone else does know more than you. And I'm just asking myself, how do we encourage these kind of moral qualities that are necessary for this whole thing to happen? Other side of the coin.
That's a good question. Foucault eventually identifies the cynics as the embodiment of parrhasia in everyday lived practice.
But they dropped out.
Well, yeah. But they're this constantly present reminder to everybody of how inauthentic their lives are. That to all you really need are these very basic things. So fundamentally, I think you're right, first off. I think the deterioration of parrhasia is not the fault of the truth teller. There are people who want to speak the truth. The assembly won't hear it. So it's a cultural failing. It's a cultural deterioration. How do you do that? You need to re-educate the culture. And that's why Foucault points to the cynics. That's what they're doing, is trying to re-educate the entire culture through their very example. What does that look like in modernity is another question entirely. I think that's the role, me personally, as somebody who's studying and teaching and talking about philosophy, that's what I see as my great calling, my great vocation, is trying to point out some of these things that we could improve on, or at least ask questions about, because I think that's how you begin to reshape kind of flawed aspects of culture. I would go so far as to say I think philosophy ought to be taught in at least high school, if not younger. There's a huge movement called Philosophy for Children that I think ought to be adopted. Good luck getting it adopted, but I think it ought to be. So I would say, how do we do this? It's up to all of us. And I meant it sincerely when I say that this is the task of philosophers, and I include all of you, because I don't mean academic philosophers. I mean people who are willingly to critically question their world and their role in it, and by extension, the role of everybody else. And I think just asking these questions is the first step. That's how do we do it? That's the beginning. After that, it's up to other people to pick it up.
It's a noble goal.